As we kick off the new year, many of us resolve to grow closer to God. But how do we actually do that? Well, we have a resource to help you do just that through our free ebook, 5 Ways to Connect with God. This resource shares 5 simple but powerful spiritual practices to deepen your relationship with God, from cultivating thankfulness to asking God for a word for the year. This guide will help you to find rest, focus, and renewed connection with God as we begin the new year. Download your copy now at premierinsight.org. Start your year off closer to God. That's premierinsight.org. Now, let's get started with today's episode.
The Ask NT Wright Anything podcast is back.
Hello, this is Tom Wright speaking to you from my study here in Oxford in England. I'm really looking forward to the fact that Mike Bird and I are relaunching the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast, looking at key questions that people have sent in, but also developing some themes that he and I have been interested in and we're eager to talk about with one another.
Listen today on your chosen podcast provider and head to asknwright.com to submit your question.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, for this time only, Dr. John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
I emphasise the doctor because we are going to be drawing extensively in this episode on Dad's past life as a consultant neonatologist for many decades, because this episode has been prompted by a fascinating long read in The Guardian, which we strongly recommend everyone have a look at. It's titled, "Look, They're Getting Skin. Are We Right to Strive to Save the World's Tiniest Babies? Doctors are pushing the limits of science and human biology to save more extremely premature babies than ever before. But when so few survive, are we putting them through needless suffering?" And the journalist, Sophie McBain, basically kind of tells the story of advances in neonatology, which is the medical discipline for premature newborn babies, and how doctors have in recent decades kind of pushed the limit of viability as far back as 21, 22 weeks old. And children being born at these ages and are being saved, not just kept alive, but sometimes kept alive without any lasting kind of disability or health concerns afterwards. But that this practice kind of throws up very challenging ethical dilemmas for parents and for clinicians as well. What did you make, Dad, as someone who worked in this exact field for many years when you read the story?
Yeah, and I think we should just say, give a health warning to listeners that inevitably we're going to be talking about some really painful, sensitive things to do with disability and death of babies. And we're well aware that, you know, a lot of people who listen to this podcast may have had some personal experiences themselves, so these are painful issues, and actually, you know, in parenthesis, that's to me always been one of the fascinations about neonatology, because it combines an extremely technically sophisticated and rather nerdy kind of approach to medicine on the one hand, with this really very deep emotional sensitive
aspect. Very human, isn't it?
It's very human. It's you know, because having babies, you know, being a father, a mother, and knowing what that means, and the preciousness of life and the fragility of life, and to hold a tiny little baby in the palm of your hands, you know, that hardly and know how precious and significant this is. I remember when I first started neonatology, which was really in the dark ages now, you know, what we would regard as the neonatal dark ages, it was actually the early 1980s. And University College Hospital in London, where I was a junior doctor, was actually pioneering a lot of the methods of trying to keep alive the tiniest babies. And had quite a sophisticated neonatal intensive care unit. In fact, it was one of the leading intensive care units in the world at the time. but it was still remarkably crude. And the babies were being delivered in one floor above in the operating room. And then the job was, how would you get this tiny little baby on the cusp of viability into the intensive care unit? And believe it or not, it was agreed that the safest and best way to do it was to resuscitate the baby initially upstairs with a doctor and a nurse. And then one of them would take the baby in their hands, cupped hands, unconnected to any tubes, race down the stairs at the back of the hospital and run into the intensive care unit with this little squirming baby in their hands, where a team was standing by, and you would instantaneously attach all the tubes and the ventilator and so on. And I can remember doing this.
Down the stairs,
I was literally running down the stairs, and you're wearing your theatre garb, so you know you're trying not to trip over your pajamas. You're carrying this squirming little baby, and I can remember I had just started as a junior doctor and was doing this, you know, and rushing with this tiny little baby who was born at 24 weeks and who weighed exactly 550 grams, and rushing with it into the intensive care unit, and one of the senior nurses looked at this baby and said, "That's not a baby, it's a fetus." And yet, remarkably, that baby survived and eventually went home and did remarkably well. And I remember 16 years later meeting this punky teenager with a stud in her ear. This was the girl that I had carried in my arms. And that's the wonder and the... Mm. You know, strange nature of it.
Yeah. And so I think before we get to tackling the kind of ethics and how us as Christian believers can think through some of the ethics of this, it's probably worth explaining a bit of the background of kind of what the advances in neonatology have been that have brought viability as low as kind of 21, 22 weeks and what challenges that throws up for parents and doctors.
Yeah, and so just a little bit of history, and it's quite an interesting, strange history, because the truth is that the care of newborn babies was not regarded as a high priority at all until relatively recently. Even though paediatrics had developed, it wasn't interested in newborn babies. And in fact, the care of newborn babies was something that was left to obstetricians. It was just part of obstetric care. So they cared for the mother during pregnancy, they managed the delivery, and then they were responsible to look after the baby after birth. And the general attitudes from doctors as a whole and from paediatricians was that premature babies should not be actively resuscitated and cared for, certainly very premature babies. And the reason for that was because they were seen as in some way biologically substandard.
Nature's rejects.
Yeah, to use a crude term, exactly right. And you know, they would take a kind of evolutionary view.
Quite Darwinian, isn't it?
It's very Darwinian. Basically, you know, here is a baby that nature in its wisdom has decided is not fit for survival. Mm. And so nature, quotes, is trying to get rid of the baby. There's something wrong with the baby. And therefore, the most compassionate and caring thing is to say, well, nature knows best, and we won't attempt to counteract nature, and instead we'll explain to the mother, we're really very sad, but nothing can be done, and the best thing for you to do, and I'm afraid they often use this kind of, just forget this, and go ahead and have another baby, and I'm sure the next baby will be fine.
So it's kind of an extension of really seeing it as a late stage miscarriage, seeing it as this is just one of those things that happens. This baby wasn't meant to be born alive or to survive to adulthood. It didn't have what it takes. That's just like part of the lottery that you play when you try to get pregnant.
That's exactly right. And therefore, the majority opinion was that you shouldn't get involved. But there were a few mavericks who said, come on, this can't be true, you know. And particularly what was happening was there was a big explosion of interest in what was happening to the physiology. Why were premature babies different from babies born at term? Why were they dying? And the focus was on the lungs. It then became apparent that the lungs were immature and that the reason they died is that they were not strong enough to be able to inflate their lungs and breathe in the way that a term baby could. And so the natural question would it be possible to keep them alive by using artificial means to inflate their lungs and give them oxygen? Because it was also realized they were dying because of shortage of oxygen. And various pioneering experiments happened and various disasters. So I don't know if you're aware of, there was a disaster when it was realized that they were all, that many of these babies were short of oxygen, and therefore the best thing to do was to nurse them in 100% oxygen.
Yes, I have heard of that. And it causes can cause blindness.
Exactly. So everybody thought, what a wonderful thing, and it seemed to help. Many babies survived, and what nobody realized that for some bizarre quirk of biology, exposing the developing retina to high levels of oxygen led to the blood vessels in the retina to go haywire and end up with blindness.
I think that's why Stevie Wonder is blind.
That is exactly right. Stevie Wonder was a premature baby born, I think, in the 60s, who was exposed to too much oxygen and who was permanently blinded as a result. And there were, tragically, thousands.
Really? It took that long before they realised. Yeah.
And of course, this was just fuel for the cynics who said, well, we told you so. But the optimist said, no, we're going to work out why it happens. And actually the hospital and a number of very highly regarded researchers devoted a lot of energy into understanding, you know, how oxygen transfers, how can we control the amount of oxygen in the bloodstream? How can we keep babies alive on mechanical ventilators? And there was a revolution. All of a sudden, premature babies started surviving, and dramatically there was improvement in survival of babies from below 30 weeks. So normal term is 40 weeks, 6 months is 26 weeks. And so babies were surviving down to 28 weeks, even 26 weeks, 25 weeks. And when I started in this field as a junior doctor in the 1980s, the big question was, should we try and resuscitate babies at 26 weeks, 25 weeks, 24 weeks? Because we know that actually the majority we can keep them alive at 28 weeks and beyond. But really, 26, 25, 24, this is pushing the limits.
And it's that envelope that has gradually, over the course of your career and since you retired, has come down lower and lower. And so now, today, if a baby was born at 26 weeks, is it fair to say every neonatologist would say, yep, let's go full all guns blazing and try and resuscitate this child? And the kind of grey area is now closer to 22 weeks.
That's right. So again, just to step back, if you go back to 1967, which was when the Abortion Act was first passed in the UK, 28 weeks was taken as the limits of viability. So the original Abortion Act took 28 weeks and said that effectively no babies ever survived below 28 weeks in the 1960s. And that's why that upper limit was taken. And the cynics said, what is going to happen is, because even in 1960s, it's important to understand that some babies did survive with disabilities. So most babies born at 28 weeks would die, but there would probably be 10% or so of babies, 20% of them, who survived. But sadly, many of those would have permanent disabilities. such as cerebral palsy, difficulty, visual impairment, learning difficulties, and so on. And as we said, the cynics said this is because they are nature's rejects. And if you try and increase survival, what's going to happen is that the mortality will go down, but the number of disabled survivors will steadily increase.
Hmm.
And this is a bad idea.
So you're not actually producing more healthy children for the world. You're just increasing, you're just saving some severely disabled children from death, but they will go on in the eyes of these doctors to live kind of low quality lives. And is that really like a good use of medical energy, professionalism, time and resources?
Exactly right. And so that's why, you know, along the way, it may be surprising to hear, but neonatologists privately have often come in for quite a lot of stick from other colleagues. Certainly in the early days, there was a lot of disquiet and questioning. You know, neonatologists were seen as the mad, the lunatic fringe who were, you know, with these crazy ideas of so it attracted mavericks. And
is that because they were feared that they were creating a pool of patients for adult doctors who would need very extensive care because of their disabilities? And so they were kind of saying, look, all you're doing, like you clock out once this child hits 40 weeks, but it's the rest of us in the other medical professions who will have to work through the lifelong ramifications of these very, very disabled children that you're producing.
Well, not only that, but they had this very patronising view of disability generally, because, you know, you're creating these quotes of vegetables, you know, that language was used, for the poor parents. What are you doing to these poor parents who are going to have a life?
Hmm.
You're wrecking the lives.
Ruining their lives by giving them this child to care for round the clock.
That's right. It was a very completely negative and very patronising attitudes towards disabled people, disabled children, and so on. Not universally, but those attitudes were common.
Hmm. And did that turn out to be the case then? As the neonatal revolution kind of kicked in, did the number of children with disabilities surviving shoot upwards?
So that was what therefore became apparent was the most important thing is to do long-term follow-up studies so we actually know the reality. And that was part of the genius of the group at UCH, who right back in the 1960s, once they realised that babies were starting to survive, they said, what we must put into place is a long-term follow-up study. We are going to follow these children all the way through to adulthood to find out what actually happens. Let's not use prejudice.
Let's do some real science.
Let's do some real science and find out what actually happens. And so there have been cohorts of children which have been studied with enormous detail all the way up to adulthood. And in fact, a research study that I was involved in is continuing to be in place. And some of the quotes, you know, preterm survivors they are now studying are in their 30s and 40s.
Wow.
And they're having MRI scans and detailed neuropsychological testing and all the rest. So it actually is happening. And I think that's one of the things I would slightly gripe with on the Guardian article, which implied nobody knows what happens to these children, which is just not true. There is a large body of research now. So we do know. But there's a very curious time warp phenomenon. And that is that the studies that are being done on 30-year-old survivors, as we speak, reflect the quality of care that was provided in the 1990s.
Yeah. Which has been
superseded. Which has completely changed. Completely superseded. Totally different. But nobody will know what the 30-year-old survival of our current cohort is until the 2050s, by which time neonatology will be completely different. So in a sense, we're always looking back. Nobody, in that sense, nobody really knows, nobody can know precisely what this group who've had a unique kind of care will have.
But what we do know is that the children at 28, 27, 26, 25 weeks who were starting to have their lives saved by doctors in the 80s, 70s, 80s and 90s, we have tracked those into adulthood now. And yep. what we do know is that they're not all quote unquote vegetables, are they?
Not at all. In fact, so just to recap, the pessimist said what's going to happen is you're going to totally increase the number of disabled people. No, 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 said my boss, who was one of the mavericks and the enthusiasts and the optimists. What's going to happen is that we're going to get so much better at understanding how brain damage happens. Not only are we going to increase the number of healthy survivors, we're going to decrease the number of children with disability because we're going to get so much better at it. And what, interestingly, the long-term follow-up study consistently shows is that both the optimists and the pessimists were wrong. In fact, the total number of healthy survivors has massively increased. The total number who die has massively decreased. And the total number who survive with impairments is about the same, give or take. And so if you were to take 26 weeks, for instance, ballpark figures of the numbers who die would be probably, of all babies born alive at 26 weeks, the numbers who die would be, off the top of my head, less than 20%. The numbers who survive effectively healthy would be about 60%. And the numbers who have some degree of disability would be about 20%.
Wow. So it was worth doing.
Absolutely. I mean, arguably, I would make the case, but of course, obviously I'm biased, that neonatal intensive care has been one of the most successful forms of high-tech medicine that's been invented in the last 50 years in terms of the number of healthy survivors. Because interestingly, if you compare those figures with adult intensive care, what's the outcome of everybody who's admitted to an adult intensive care unit? They are far, far worse. In fact, the number of healthy survivors coming out of adult intensive care units is relatively small.
Really?
An awful lot die. And of those who survive, a significant amount number have some kind of disability. And yet we all of us feel that adult intensive care units, it's worth giving people a chance. It's worth throwing the book at them.
And we had those dilemmas, didn't we, in the COVID years, when there was concerns that certain, you know, at the height of some of those waves of the virus, that we would run out of ventilators and beds in adult intensive cares, and we would have to do that horrible triage of trying to figure out whose life is worth saving. But on the whole, I think in most places it didn't get to that point and we were able to give everyone intensive care who needed it.
That's true, although the reality was that doctors became much more selective than they were before, in terms, particularly in terms of elderly people with multiple morbidities who previously would have been admitted to an intensive care unit. The intensivists became more ruthless in one sense to say, we will only admit those who have a realistic chance of doing well.
And I suppose going back to the NICUs, the neonatal intensive care units, not only does, as you say, have quite impressively high kind of survival rates, but every one of those children who you save and discharge has 80 to 90 years of life ahead of them. So, you know, to use the kind of the quality adjusted life year measure that some, you know, medical philosophers and even, you know, NHS bodies use to determine if treatments are worthwhile, it must have some of the best ratings of all, because, you know, if you put in a few months hard work and this child gets 85, 90 years of healthy life after it, that's a pretty good result. Pretty good bang for your buck, isn't it?
No, that's absolutely right. In fact, it's embarrassingly the case that if you just use crude qualities, neonatal intensive care comes up very high, not quite as good as something like vaccination, which
is much cheaper than a ventilator.
It's exceptionally good value for money, but it does very well. Whereas in contrast, geriatrics, all geriatric medicine does really badly. Yeah. And of course, palliative care is the ultimate money disaster. They're all going to die.
Which is why we shouldn't really run a healthcare system purely on finance and mathematics.
But also, just as an aside, in what I always think is a cheat, the health economists come along and they say, oh, no. Yes, your baby is going to live for 80 years, perfectly healthy, but that doesn't get you 80 qualities. No, I'm sorry. Because we discount future qualities. They're not as worth as much. And the further they are in the future, the less valuable they are.
They taper off.
Yeah.
That's cheating, isn't it?
Because all the evidence is, you know, and this is kind of psychology more than maths. You know, if how much do you value what's going to happen in the next 6 months? You value it very highly. How much do you value what's going to happen when you're 80?
Not top of my priority list right now.
So, in fact, as I remember, 80 qualities at the beginning of life is actually discounted to something like 25.
Outrageous.
But even so, we still do very well.
I don't know about you, but sometimes I have big questions about life, and I want thoughtful answers. That's why we're excited that we have this resource to offer called Ask NT Wright Anything, 12 Crucial Questions About Faith, the Bible, and Life. This ebook distills wisdom from one of the world's leading theologians, NT Wright, tackling topics like life after death, the reliability of scripture, predestination, and more. It's our hope that this resource will strengthen your faith and deepen your understanding. And here's the best part. It's our thank you gift when you give to support Premier Insight this month. So don't miss this opportunity to grow in your faith. Visit premierinsight.org to give today. That's premierinsight.org. Thank you for your generosity. And now let's get back to today's episode.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Okay, so let's return back to the kind of the core ethical dilemma at the heart of the Guardian article and the neonatology work in general is that whatever the point the technology has developed, there is a cutoff point, there is a grey area where at a certain gestational age, it is difficult to assess whether it is quote unquote worth trying to save this baby's life. And let's just dwell on that for a second, because I think some people listening will find that hard to believe that how could it be ever not trying to save a child's life, particularly as Christians, how could it ever be the ethical thing to do to say, we're just going to control this child's pain, make sure they're comfortable, but we're not going to do the full battery of neonatal interventions?
Yeah, and so here I think it's important to understand the state of the law and current medical law, which in many ways is based on, still, thankfully, is based on Christian and Judeo-Christian principles. So what the law says with regard to children is that there is a binding duty on parents and on doctors always to act in the child's best interests. That is the fundamental medical duty. And the law then is quite clear that the best interests of the patient includes their medical best interests. In other words, you know, what's best for their brain function and their mobility and so on. But it is much wider than that. It also includes psychological, familial, the history of their attitude, everything. All of this must be brought in together to decide whether this treatment is in the patient's best interest. And to give a treatment which is not in the best interest of the patient, and in particular a harmful treatment, a treatment where the burdens of the treatment are worse than the benefits, is both illegal and unethical. Sadly, it happens all the time in medicine. You know, what happens all the time is that treatments are given which actually do more harm than good. But nonetheless, that's wrong. We should never give treatments that do more harm than good.
And that seems easy to get your head around when you're thinking about, you know, should I take this particular medication? It might treat this part of my disease, but it has these side effects. And if we decide the side effects are actually going to be more harmful, then fine, that makes sense. But how could it ever be in a person's best interest to die as opposed to be alive, even if the treatment might cause their life to be difficult? I mean, people might struggle to reconcile the idea that it could ever be in my best interest to not be alive.
So the question comes, I mean, and just let's take two extreme examples. Let's take a baby born at 18 weeks gestation. And the baby is born alive and is wriggling and trying to breathe. And the question is, you know, to us as a medical team, should we intervene to try to save that baby's life? Should we put tubes into the, you know, it would be possible. We can do it. We can get a tube into the lungs. We can, you know, put the baby in an incubator. We can do all this kind of stuff. Is that an appropriate thing? Is that in the best interest? If you were being born at 18 weeks, would you want this to be done? And the answer is no, it is not in the best interest, because no baby has ever survived at 18 weeks gestation. And yet we could keep this baby alive for minutes, hours, even days. For what purpose? It's not in the baby's best
interest. It would just be kind of medical hubris.
Yeah.
If it's fundamentally inevitable, the child's death is coming anyway.
And we are creating discomfort. We are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're doing interventions to this baby for what reason? This is just madness. Mm. And the burdens of the treatment clearly outweigh any kind of benefit. So in that case, it seems pretty clear. Now take a baby born at 28 weeks gestation. If we do nothing, they'll die. But if we do this, yes, it's going to cause some discomfort. It's going to cause spending a lot of money. It's going to, you know, mean the baby's going to be in hospital for weeks or months. And yet the statistics are absolutely clear that this baby has a sort of 90% chance of surviving and maybe a 5% chance of 5 to 10% chance of surviving with some significant disability. Is it in the baby's best interest? And I think there's an overwhelming view. Yes, absolutely. It is in the baby's best interest.
We should. If you go and ask those children when they're adults, are you glad the doctors saved your life?
Yeah.
I think everyone says yes.
Absolutely, they do. Which is equally true of those born with significant disabilities. So it's just an important aside. People have done detailed quality of life studies in ex-premature survivors. And they have universally found that even ex-premature survivors with significant disabilities tend to rate their lives very highly. And if you ask the question, now let me ask you, you know, are you glad that you're alive, or do you think it would have been better if we switched off the machines? The most likely response is to get a punch in the nose. You know, who do you think you are?
It's a pretty offensive question, isn't
it? To question whether my life is worth living.
And this ties into, on a side note, why so many disability groups are so hostile to assisted dying and assisted suicide, is because they feel like, well, the most people most likely at risk of this are the well-meaning but ignorant, able-bodied population who looks at them and presumes that death would be better than this life. Whereas they say, actually, no, come and ask me and I'll tell you that this life is better than being dead. But they correctly perceive that the rest of society has no insight into the experience of being disabled and cannot imagine that it is a tolerable existence, let alone a positive existence.
I think I've recounted this anecdote before, but it made a big impression on me. I was at a major international paediatric conference when someone presented some original research where they had followed up a whole cohort of extremely preterm babies up into adolescence. They had done quality of life studies on the adolescents. They then approached their parents and asked the parents to rate their adolescents' quality of life. And then they approached the paediatricians who were caring for them and asked the paediatricians to rate their quality of life. And predictably, the adolescents themselves gave the highest quality of life. The parents gave a lower but not so low quality of life, and the paediatricians gave the lowest quality of life. And when these results were presented to the audience, and there was then a general debate, to my utter consternation, guess what the general conclusion was?
The doctors were right.
And the others were using some kind of weird psychological mechanism to persuade themselves that their lives were better than they actually were.
Which is insane, because the quality of your life is a fundamentally subjective measure that only the individual can truly assess if their life is a high quality or not.
Well, that's true unless you're a doctor. But of course, Tim, what you don't understand...
The doctors have this special ability to know better than me myself whether I'm enjoying my life.
We know, Tim. Yeah, you make these protestations. We doctors know, Tim, that actually...
You'd be better off dead. Yeah, well, that is sobering. And I think, you know, gives fuel to the fire of some people to say, you know, we can't entrust doctors as a profession with some of these life or death questions.
Quite.
So, again, to return to neonatology.
Well, let me just, again, aside, which is really interesting, and that is that if you ask doctors' attitudes towards disability as a whole, clinicians, and you compare them with the general public, you find that doctors are very skewed towards being frightened about disability, concerned, have negative perspectives on it, and also being frightened of pain, more so than the general public. The general public have more positive attitudes towards disability and more positive attitudes towards pain and suffering than clinicians do as a whole. And the doctors say, well, the reason for this, of course, is that we understand these things. We actually know what it's like to be a premature baby. We know, we've watched people with disabilities, and we know how much they struggle. So we have the accurate view. But there is another view, and that is the psychiatric view that says, ah, yes, little Johnny, but why did you go into medicine in the first place? Answer, because you were so overwhelmed with fears of disability and suffering that you went into, in a bizarre psychological mechanism, you went into medicine in order to control these deep fears,
anxieties, you know, around becoming a patient yourself. Yeah. And it's alarming, because I think people often say, you know, the cure for stigma is greater knowledge. But actually, it's the general public who are ignorant of the reality of being in pain or being disabled who have apparently more compassion and more empathy and more and a less heightened sense of anxiety about. Whereas the people who have a much richer understanding of what it is to be disabled or in pain, apparently the people who are most fearful of it. So,
yeah,
slightly alarming.
So anyway, to come back to the grey zone has always been there. But what has happened is the grey zone has shifted with advances in medicine. And for a long time, Britain had taken, there was a sort of a general agreement that you should have what they called a week-by-week guide to what to do. And that basically said that 24 weeks and above, yes, you should give maximal intensive care. 22 weeks and below, no, you shouldn't. 23 weeks is a grey zone, and you talk to the parents.
And would it literally be the parents' choice? I mean, if the parents in the 23-week grey zone strongly said, we demand that you do everything for our child, would the doctors say, okay, then, we'll try?
Well, no, it isn't. And because what the law is clear is that there has to be a collaboration between the parents and the doctors. The doctors and the parents must agree together on what is the best interest of their child. And in cases where the doctors and the parents disagree, we should then go back to the courts. So rather than say, well, the parents want it, so we'll do it, or, well, the doctor is going to do it, so we'll do it, the argument should be that we should go back to the courts. Now, of course, this is difficult because we're dealing with an emergency situation where a baby is about to be born and where life and death decisions have to be made. And so the consensus is that wherever possible, we should be having these conversations with parents before the baby is born. We should be discussing with them what they would like to happen, what are the possibilities, what are the options. And together coming to a consensus about how to manage the situation. On a technical point, I am strongly against this week by week approach, because what both clinical experience and reality teaches us, and theoretical teaches us, is that every baby is different. Every baby has a unique constellation of different risk factors. And therefore, just teaching every baby as though they were exactly the same and saying, well, 24 weeks, oh, yeah, we'll do this. Oh, 23 weeks, oh, yeah, is brain dead. You know, what we've got to do is individualize our care. Yes, we use all the data that's available, but we then try wisely to apply that to this particular baby, this combination of circumstances, to try to work out what are the chances that this baby will survive and what are the risks of disability and so on. And then to have this discussion with the parents where you say, to be honest, nobody can know for certain, but we think this is our best understanding of the likelihood. And what I've had these conversations with parents is that I try to express it in a way which is say, to be honest, we really don't know what is the best. What is for the best? Would it be just to keep the baby comfortable, but not to do, make sure the baby doesn't suffer, but we're not going to start invasive intensive care? Or do you feel we should at least give the baby a chance? We should do everything possible. We can always change our minds, is what I would say, and it's true. We can always, so sometimes it's what I would call provisional intensive care. We start, we give the baby a chance, we do everything possible. If it then becomes apparent that things are far worse than we thought, we can always, with your agreement, stop. We can switch off the machinery, we can allow the baby to die.
And because this gets to one of the challenging things about this grey zone is that the reason, you know, which the Guardian article kind of goes into, is the reason viability has come down is not because of like massive game changing new technologies or techniques have suddenly been developed, but through kind of small incremental improvements. There's a quote from a retired consultant neurologist: everything is better. It's better ventilation, better equipment, better trained people, better nutrition, better optimization, steroids, antibiotics. And so the kind of viability is almost self-fulfilling, as the quote, the article, extremely premature babies won't survive unless doctors try to save them, and they won't try to save them unless they believe they have a chance of succeeding. And so the survival rate among the world's youngest babies is determined by an extent to what doctors believe is possible and what they believe is ethical. And then, you know, the journalist interviews one of these neonatologists who kind of was one of the first in America to kind of push the envelope and try saving 21-week-old babies, 22-week-old babies. And so I guess when you phrase it as you did at the start of, you know, an 18-week-old baby will definitely die, and so clearly any medical treatment is unethical and invasive and futile and shouldn't be attempted. A 20-week-year-old, 20-weeker will definitely survive if we try. So why would 28 weeks, sorry. The grey zone there, you could say a 22-weekers always die, and so we've never tried and they always do die, and so it's unethical. Or you say, I'm going to take the 1% chance of a 22-weeker surviving and throw everything at it. And, you know, and the journalist says, you know, that when this doctor, Dr. Edward Bell, first started doing this, most of the babies carried on dying. And so there's almost a kind of morbid masochistic element of he kept trying until eventually he picked up enough knowledge and built a team around him in his hospital, and they started saving, you know, 1 in 5, which became, you know, 1 in 3 and 1 in 2. But kind of the ethics almost change depending on your ability to kind of push the envelope, and potentially the first few babies, maybe it wasn't ethical to do it, but it's now pushed the envelope so much and it now becomes ethical for a 22-weeker to be tried to save.
No, that's absolutely right. And that's why so often advances in medicine come from mavericks who are prepared to question the orthodoxy. Mm. You know, and there were stories like that about my boss, Professor Reynolds, who was one of the pioneers, and he was utterly convinced there must be a way of keeping these babies alive. They were all dying because their lungs became solid and were, and he put them onto these the primitive ventilators they had at the time, and they had a temporary improvement, and then they would slowly deteriorate and eventually die despite everything possible being done. And the story was that whenever they had a baby on a ventilator, they didn't have very many of them, whenever they had one, he would come in and he would stay in the hospital at the bedside, desperately trying to work out how to do it, twiddling the knobs until the baby died. And for, I think it was something like 18 months, this went on, and every single baby that he spent at the bedside died. And I think most people would have, at this point, would have said,
This is a
waste of time. You know, there are better ways to spend my life. But Reynolds was absolutely persuaded it was possible, if only he could work out how to do it. And after 18 months, he cracked it. He worked out how to do it. And babies started surviving that previously had all universally died. And he wrote up the method in a prominent medical journal. And it went round the world, and everybody started doing the same thing, and everybody found the same. And it became called Reynolds-style ventilation, and it was the great new thing. But it all came out of this extraordinary commitment. And I had spent many hours with Osborne. I respected him deeply. He was a wonderful man, a very compassionate, caring doctor, as well as a brilliant clinician and scientist. And he wasn't a Christian believer, but he was deeply motivated by Christian ethics. He deeply felt doing the best for these babies and helping them to survive was worth sacrificing his own life, really, you know, to everything, because that was important. That was worth it.
Because it struck me when you were talking earlier about the kind of clash within medicine and why some doctors strongly resisted the rise of neonatology, and this idea that, you know, nature has rejected them. Why should we try and save them? It's not our place to try and interfere. These are, quote unquote, defective. That struck me as a kind of a pre-Christian value system, you know, almost an extension of that kind of, you know, famous thing they did in Sparta, where they would examine newborn babies, you know, in ancient Sparta in Greece. And if they were not physically perfect, they would be discarded and left to die. And we're kind of, we don't do that at birth anymore, but we're kind of doing it now, you know, preterm. It seems quite antithetical to the Christian idea that every human being has an intrinsic value and worth because they're made in the image of their creator God. And what Reynolds was doing was kind of recognizing in these tiny babies that they were equivalent in worth and value to him as an adult human being, even though he wouldn't have used the language of image of God, and therefore it was worthy of his own suffering to spend himself on behalf of another human being, a fellow member of the kind of human community.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, I think. And so the fascinating thing is, if you go back to this, the early Christian era, you know, you've got your dominant Greco-Roman culture, which, and the Christians are a small, weird sect. But interestingly, Christian philosophy and Roman philosophy actually agreed about a lot. I mean, the foundations of Roman law, of common law, about property rights, about, you know, respect for individual choice, about protecting adult life, about homicide, you know, appealing to Caesar, you know, all these things, Christians found that their own Christian philosophy matched with early Roman law. A lot of it came from Stoicism, and they found a common. But where it completely differed, it differed at several things. It differed on the role of slaves, the value of a slave's life. It differed on the role of women, where the women counted, and it completely different on the value of a baby. Because to the Romans, the babies effectively were replaceable, and the only value of a baby was its potential for the future. Yeah, it could grow up to be a farmer, or
the heir to your valuable estate.
Yeah, or even the next Caesar. Okay, that's great. But if it was of low value, low status, low potential, then just check it out. Have another one.
Yeah.
And the Christians said, no, but Jesus was a baby. And all babies are precious. Because Jesus was a baby, all babies are precious. And the
gospel writers were clear to record that famous incident, let the little children come to me.
Yeah.
That it wasn't just that this one baby was special, but it's that even adult Jesus recognized in a profoundly countercultural way that there was value and worth in children, which I suspect in kind of first century Jewish culture, they were similarly seen as kind of...
No, that's not... Interestingly, that's not right, I think, if I may correct you. Jewish culture was the outlier. Because think about Moses, the baby Moses.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Egyptians said, oh, well, just get rid of him. But Jewish culture had always seen protecting babies as important. And in fact, it was Moloch and the pagan gods that sacrificed their children.
Which the Jews found particularly abhorrent.
It was particularly abhorrent, yeah. So the Jewish culture had always, but it was a minority culture that really, they had their own rules. But for the first time in Christianity starts challenging the normal attitude toward children. And
the Christians become famous for collecting other people's discarded, exposed babies and raising them as their own. And this is something that lots of non-Christian writers, historians, keep coming on about, this bizarre sect. And do you know, one of the things they do is they go around scooping up babies that have been abandoned and raising them in their own, develop their own kind of, proto-orphanages, effectively. Yeah.
What do they see in them? Especially the babies of pagans. I mean, okay, they look after their own babies, but they even seem to think the babies of pagans are special. Mm. So, yeah. And interestingly, that sense that even the most vulnerable lives are precious, that has always been the driving force of a lot of Western medicine. And so in that sense, Reynolds wasn't unusual. That's why doctors devote themselves to life. And why we fight even when we knew it was impossible.
There's a sense that death is an enemy, not a natural part of life, but something to be resisted, something that it was an intruder. And they maybe, modern NHS doctors wouldn't ever frame it like this, but that is fundamentally the idea that actually human beings were not made to die, but God's original and overarching intention is for us to live with him forever.
We're on the side of life, and we probably ought to draw the threads together. But of course, this is where medicine changes from being fundamentally on the side of life, but yet nonetheless recognizing, we're not vitalists in the sense that every breath is what matters. We just carry on.
Because I think that's an important thing to dwell on, because I think a lot of Christians would follow the thread there and say, right, we're pro-life people in all circumstances. And you see that, some campaigning groups like Christian Concern, who have got involved in some of these difficult court cases, Archie Battersby and other ones like that, where parents and doctors are at odds about whether they should withdraw life support for sick children. The Christians say, well, obviously we're on the side of the parents who want to pursue life support at all costs. And yet we've, on this very podcast, made the argument that no, sometimes the ethical Christian thing to do is to allow a child, a sick patient, to die. So does this flesh out how we can be both, people who see death as an enemy and be people who are pro-life people because of our Christian ethics. And at the same time, it is sometimes medically and, spiritually the right thing to do to not forestall death.
Yeah, and this is a really deep philosophical, ethical, but also practical issue. But if I was to try to summarize it as briefly as possible, I would say this is because of the unique Christian understanding of death, that death is not the end. Death is not physical. Death is not the ultimate tragedy, the greatest evil that could possibly happen. Death is an enemy, but it's not the ultimate enemy. Or at least it's not the enemy which has not been defeated. You know, the Christian message is that God in Jesus has triumphed over death, that there is something that comes beyond death, which for believers can be a most amazing, that's the Christian hope, a most wonderful healing. There are some situations where God offers healing, but the only healing that comes is not through ventilators and intensive care units, but is actually paradoxically through death itself. Death changes from being the ultimate enemy to becoming a strange kind of healing, a gateway into the next stage. And so what we say to this little baby who we can't keep alive is tragically, I can't overcome death, physical death for you, but, you know, I believe by God's grace there's something better for you beyond the grave, and that rather than keep you here till that very last moment and torture you to at least, you know, stave off the inevitable, it's better for me to give you palliative care, to put you in the arms of your parents, to weep together, for you to be loved and cuddled and sung over, and in hope that we will meet again. And one of the wonderful scriptures, which means a lot to me, and I've often quoted in this circumstance to parents of dying babies or dead babies, is that strange and mysterious verse where Jesus says, "Don't despise these little ones, because I tell you their angels always behold the face of my Father in heaven." And it's a sort of mysterious phrase, but I think it's a reference to the significance of little lives. They're not forgotten. They're not wasted. They're not discarded. In fact, maybe they have a special place of honour.
And you said to me before, that's partly why you felt drawn as a Christian doctor to the practice of neonatology, to devote your clinical career to that, because it feels like a space saving these tiny babies' lives where you can and where you can't, allowing them to have a kind of dignified and comfortable death, and comforting the parents in their grief feels like a particularly Christian redemptive aspect of medicine.
Yeah, and this was the genius of those who came before, particularly Cicely Saunders and others like that, who saw palliative care. It comes out of a Christian understanding of death. It's that it's not the ultimate disaster, and that dying well and helping babies to die well. You know, she concentrated on babies. I and others felt, well, can't we take the same principles and help babies to die well? Not out of a deep sense of failure. And so one of my lines, you know, which is I still believe, and that is to allow a baby to die well, at peace, loved and settled in the arms of the parents, can be as much a triumph of neonatal intensive care as to send the baby home undamaged and unscathed by their experiences. They're both triumphs.
Yeah. And this fundamental Judeo-Christian idea of valuing the life of all, and, you know, what Reynolds was doing in spending himself to try and save a few more lives, that is fundamentally what is at risk, isn't it, in the debates around assisted dying and about introducing that to the health service, which we've been covering on the podcast in recent months as the UK begins the process of legalising assisted dying, is that it cuts away the kind of core foundation of Judeo-Christian Western medicine, because it says actually sometimes doctors should take active steps to procure the death of a patient who might otherwise live.
Yes. So this, you know, ever since the, you know, it's not an accident that modern medical care actually grows out of the Christian heritage. It's not an accident that modern medical care doesn't come from the Eastern religions, out of Hinduism and Buddhism or Stoicism. It comes out of Christianity, and in many ways, modern medical care is a triumph of Christian, you know, it's doing God's work, battling against death. And you know, if you want to put it in theological terms, this is about eschatology. We are pointing towards the ultimate defeat of death. This whole enterprise is anticipated or inaugurated eschatology.
Whereas other philosophical religious traditions are often quite fatalistic about death. And, you know, a lot of Eastern traditions, for example, would see death as a completely natural part of the cycle of life, not necessarily a bad thing, not something that the gods would have any interest in stopping or preventing or overcoming or defeating.
That's right. And the godly thing to do is just to accept, you know, and to recognise that it's actually of trivial importance. It's of nothing. Death is nothing at all. That's not a Christian view. So I think once you introduce deliberately some kind of welcoming of death, of hastening death, of introducing death, once the doctor becomes a killer, even motivated by compassion, even saying, yeah, but I'm doing it definitely for you, you know, and it's a most wonderful and joyful thing. Once the doctor has changed their role, you know, many of us feel something utterly catastrophic and possibly irreversible has entered into the nature of healthcare.
And I think this is instructive as well why so many medical professionals who aren't directly working in, you know, geriatrics or palliative care, who aren't seeing the kind of terminally ill patients on a daily basis who would be ostensibly covered by these laws, still feel so strongly about it, you know, is because philosophically and spiritually and theologically, once you cross that Rubicon, it has ripple effects for the rest of medicine. And I don't think it's hyperbole to say that once assisted dying becomes embedded in the healthcare system, you then start opening up questions that were previously settled, such as, you know, should we be spending all this time and effort to keep alive these potentially very disabled premature children?
Or elderly, expensive, multiply impaired adults.
Yeah. Or people suffering from complex mental health disorders and, you know, the whole idea of, which was previously unthinkable, which is that a doctor never looks at a sick person and says, the best thing to do is to kill you. Once you introduce that idea, you do undercut cut the legs from underneath the entire kind of Judeo-Christian medical tradition.
And that's the worry. And I think that's why I and some other people feel that if this does become embedded in the NHS, then those of us who are viscerally and utterly opposed to it are going to have to try and create some kind of safe spaces that are safe both for doctors and for patients. But that's another discussion.
It is. All right, well, we're here now. We should probably draw things to a close. Thanks so much for listening. I've put a link to the Guardian article that sparked this conversation, which I really strongly recommend having a read. It's very well done and kind of draws out some really important questions for us to think about. Put a link to that in the notes of this podcast. There's plenty more on neonatal ethics on Dad's website, drawing from his many years writing and researching and thinking on this topic. That's johnwyatt.com. And we'd love to know your own thoughts, particularly those of you who might have had children born prematurely, experienced baby loss in some other way, who've been at the kind of sharp end of these dilemmas. Or those who work in medicine. We'd love to hear your own thoughts on some of the ethical questions we've been raising or suggestions. Thanks to those who sent in this article for us to look at. It was a really good idea. But yeah, if you've seen something online that you think should prompt a conversation for us, please or do also get in touch. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. And you can get in touch. I should say you can see some of my journalism at my website, tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Save big money on your kitchen project at Menards. We carry everything you need to turn your kitchen dreams into reality. Renovate your space with new cabinets from Cardell. They're ready to install and come in a variety of styles. Visit our kitchen showrooms in-store or go to Menards.com for free estimates today. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for all of our hot deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.